This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip around the world with As It Happens. From the complex headlines of the day to the weird and wacky, As It Happens brings you the story behind the story. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/as it happens.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. They are praiseworthy journals in the world of medicine and research. The Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Clinical Oncology. But a new study from researchers at the University of Toronto's Princess Margaret Cancer Centre suggests not everything they publish is deserving of praise. The Canadian study reviewed 164 trials for breast cancer treatments and found that researchers frequently spin their results to paint them in a more positive light while underplaying the negative side effects of the drugs being researched or the treatments being researched. Dr. Ian Tannock led the study, which was just published in the Annals of Oncology, and he is in our Toronto studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
You say in your study you found a high proportion of spin and bias when researchers report their results for publication. What do you mean by that?
Well, when a study is designed, it's basically designed to determine whether there might be improvement in one important outcome measure. That might be the time of survival, or it might be the time for the disease to come back. And they compare two treatments, and usually there is a difference in toxicity between those treatments, and very frequently the new treatment is the more toxic. So what we found when we reviewed these studies is that about half of them were positive in that the primary outcome measure was different in favor of the new treatment. But particularly in those that were negative, instead of just concluding that, they used a much less important outcome measure to make them look positive. So that occurred in a third of them. And secondly, we looked to see in the abstract of the paper, which is what most busy clinicians like me read, to see to what extent there was a report of toxicity. And that was rarely reported in any comprehensive way, so that there was an impression that the studies were often better in terms of showing improvement in the new treatment and underestimating their toxicity.
When you say toxicity, are you talking about adverse effects?
I'm talking about adverse side effects of the treatments.
And we're not just talking drugs, we're also talking radiotherapy?
A little bit, but the majority, there were some radiotherapy studies, there were some surgical studies, but the vast majority of these were looking at new drugs or combinations of drugs compared with standard treatment.
Now, you use the phrase high proportion. How high is high?
Well, one-third of the studies did not have their final concluding statement of the abstract looking at that primary outcome measure, which the study was designed to look at. So one-third failed in that respect, and two-thirds failed to have a sentence that summarized the toxicity of the study in that abstract of the paper.
Did this surprise you?
We obviously did the study because we were aware of poor reporting. That stimulated it. I was surprised at the extent to which we found it in these large studies in high-ranking journals.
And what do you think is driving this?
It's hard to say. I think it's a mixture of things. We didn't find specifically an effect of pharmaceutical sponsorship, but I think that conclusion's a bit weak because particularly in some of the earlier studies, they may simply not have disclosed pharmaceutical pressure because that clearly exists. The pharmaceutical companies want to sell their new drugs, which are on patent more expensive, and there is a tendency to make studies evaluating them look better. But I think there's also pressure on the physicians and researchers themselves. Most of them want to have their studies noted. It's much easier to publish a positive than a negative study or to publish it in a higher ranking, well-noticed journal. And I think there are pressures to succeed in that way, succeed in obviously inverted commas.
Of course, I mean, we're talking people who spend years doing these studies, right?
Absolutely.
So that would be, you want something to show for it at the end.
All of these studies were trials that were randomizing patients between two different treatments, and all of them had a minimum of 200 patients included in them. We didn't consider smaller trials. So yes, all of these were large trials that take a lot of time and a lot of financing too.
What are the implications for the health of women undergoing breast cancer treatment?
I think that this poor reporting can lead to physicians sometimes using often newer treatments that aren't really better than standard ones, that may be more toxic and are almost invariably more expensive. I don't think it has an effect on actual approval of new drugs, because organizations like the FDA in the States and Health Canada here, they look much more comprehensively at studies. They don't just look at the abstract of the paper. But once a new treatment is approved, the companies would like it to be used in a much more general way. And I think there is an influence to push for new treatments being used rather than old ones.
But and so if we follow that thread, there are a lot of women listening right now who are being treated for breast cancer. Could they be getting the wrong treatment? Could they be getting something that they think is going to help them that won't in the end?
I think it's unusual for them to get the totally wrong treatment. They usually are elements of grayness in choosing a treatment. Sometimes I think they may not be getting the optimal treatment.
And that matters.
That matters.
And in terms of their physicians as well, I mean, you just pointed out that most of you read the shorthand on these things because you're so busy.
Yes.
So does this mean a lot of doctors doing the treatment may be making decisions with information that is inaccurate?
I think it's, you know, usually they're not actually telling lies. They're including other components of the trial that are less important that may, by chance, make it just look a little bit more positive. So I think it can lead to suboptimal treatment. And it's so easy to correct. If the editors would just have a simple checklist for the reviewers of these papers asking the question, was the primary outcome measure used in making the concluding statement of the abstract? And was there an appropriate statement of toxicity in that abstract? All of this could be avoided.
Now, when researchers begin the research, they actually have a statement of goals, right? That you found that changed as well, did you not?
Yes, we did. Now, it's not. We could only look at that in a small number of trials. But beginning about, 7 or 8 years ago, there was a requirement for anybody who was going to undertake or lead a clinical trial to register that trial and to include in that registry the important components of it, namely including the primary outcome measure. So in the more recent trials, we were able to look to see if the final outcome measure that was reported was the same as that registered when the trial was begun. And that was only a small proportion of the trials, because we couldn't do that for the older ones. But of those that were registered, about a quarter of them, there was a change in that primary outcome measure. And in general, that primary outcome measure was changed to a different one so that the study looked more positive. The original one could be negative and the new one could be positive.
In other words, we didn't get what we thought we were going to get, but let's say we got this.
That's exactly right.
Again, I mean, for those of us who are lay people, the idea that this kind of changing is going on is pretty staggering.
It's pretty staggering.
So what's the answer?
Well, I think the answer is, as I've said, to have more guidelines that are and checklists so that I don't think the editors of the journals really want this to happen, but they could so easily prevent it by having simple checklists for those reviewing and evaluating the papers that are sent to them. Because all of these studies, you know, if you report a clinical trial, you submit it to one of the journals you mentioned at the beginning, or of course many others, the editors then send those papers out to be reviewed to experts in the field. Those people are clearly not doing their job in letting these papers get by with this reporting that is suboptimal.
Ian Tanak, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Dr. Ian Tanak is a medical oncologist and a senior scientist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto. Well, to respond to some of these concerns raised by Dr. Tanak's research, I'm joined by Dr. John Fletcher. He is the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. He is in our Ottawa studio. Good morning.
Hello, good morning, Anna Maria.
Now, well, as someone who's responsible for publishing medical research, how concerned are you by Dr. Tanak's findings?
Well, I'm concerned, although not surprised, because there have been other reviews like this in other areas, in cardiovascular medicine and other sorts of conditions. So this does confirm what's been known before, that there is some bias in the reporting of the outcomes of studies. It's a little concerning. I was particularly surprised and worried by the fact that researchers are changing their primary outcome. And I guess the other thing that's concerning is that editors do have checklists already. There's been a whole movement to produce guidelines for reporting of trials, and randomized control trials would usually be reported on the using consort checklist, which journals like the New England Journal and Lancet and CMAJ use to judge whether authors are sticking to the guidelines. So it's sort of worrying that even with these guidelines, editors are missing the trick.
Do you think it diminishes the credibility of medical journals such as your own?
Well, we're in the business of publishing research and getting it out so that people can read it. I think what I'd want to emphasize is that it's sometimes best not to take the results of the latest or the newest research, but to wait until several studies have been summarized together in a systematic review. And systematic reviews look at the broad thrust of research across several studies, and the reviewers read carefully in the way that busy clinicians often don't, and perhaps even sometimes editors, and read carefully to assure that the studies are not biased in a way that Dr. Tanak has pointed out that they can be.
You know, it's interesting. First of all, who's reading the CMAJ? It's for doctors, am I right? And clinicians.
Well, it's for doctors, and it's we're a member organization. 70,000 doctor members across the country receive CMAJ, and then about 2 million people per year read it on the website. We're less sure who those people are, but a mixture of people.
Well, that's why I'm asking, because there is a mix, and including a lot of lay people, including medical journalists and non-medical journalists. I mean, there's a lot of room for misinterpretation then, it would seem.
Yes, and I think we should always remind people to beware of what you read. It was a good good lead into the topic, that getting your information from the latest piece of research may not be the best thing. But many of these journals also have sections of reviews or commentaries by expert, which I think are more reliable in gauging what the best treatments are.
And so what kind of oversight or vetting procedures does your journal do or have when it comes to reviewing a research paper that might raise some questions?
Well, we use a two-stage process for selecting papers, and this is in common with a lot of the large medical journals. Editors, first of all, read the papers and screen out ones that they think are worth publishing. We then use outside experts, so external peer review. We do try to use the guidelines and checklists of good reporting that have been promoted by the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors and by researchers putting together guidelines and checklists. I think part of the reason that some of these findings come about that Dr. Tanak was raising is the incentives for journals in what they publish.
How so?
Well, a lot of the big journals are funded by the people who read them, either directly by subscriptions or indirectly by the advertising revenue that comes from a large number of readers. So medical journals try to pick articles and research that they think are going to be well read. Now, a study that says, we looked at this drug and we're not sure if it works, doesn't make for a good read, but some sort of headline saying new drug works in cancer or old drug produces harms is much more headline grabbing and more likely to grab readers and more likely to assure the financial success of the journal. So in a sense, in the funding model of major medical journals, we have this bias built in.
You know, there were serious concerns raised about drug trials and their reporting of those trials in prestigious medical journals in the past. I'm thinking of the SSRIs, the antidepressants that were on the market that were later to have found side effects that were related to teen suicide. There was the case of arthritis drugs that were related to heart problems. Can some of this actually be caught at the journal publication level?
Gosh, I'm not sure whether you can spot those things early on. It's when there's a larger body of evidence that it starts to become a big story and something that's going to make headlines. But early on, when it's still very vague, very difficult to catch. One of the new initiatives, again from the ICMJE, the International Committee of Medical Journal of Editors, is to ask trialists to make an extra effort to list all the bad effects of the trial and the drugs in the trial. And that I think springs out of those scandals that you mentioned, because before that recommendation, it was not necessary to report in detail the bad side effects, and trials would concentrate on reporting just the good outcomes.
And they also have to register their trials, I guess, now in order to be published.
Yes, that's a matter of trying to ensure that reports of trials report on what they set out to do, rather than cherry picking the things that seem to work.
John Fletcher, I'd like you to stand by if you could, and I'll bring you back. But we'd like to bring someone else into this discussion. Dr. Anwen Chan is a scientist at Women's College Hospital and Research Institute in Toronto. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Toronto and an expert on the quality of clinical trials and bias. Last week, he and a group of experts released a statement calling for a checklist to improve clinical trials. And Anwen Chan is in our Toronto studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, before we get into your larger concerns about bias in research, you've heard what the medical journals are trying to do to require researchers to register and other things in order to be published. How far does that go in dealing with the spin or bias in a trial study?
Well, I feel that registering the trial before it begins is an important first step. It was initially called for actually about 30 years ago. And the journal editors played a critical role in ensuring that now more trials are being registered. However, we also know, based on several studies, that trial registration is not working as well as we would hope. We don't know exactly how many trials are being registered among all trials, but of the studies that have been published, we know that maybe half of trials are currently unregistered. Even among those that are registered, we know that the quality of information that is placed on those registries is highly variable. For example, when we talk about the primary endpoints or outcome measures that Dr. Tanak's study looked at, we know that only about half of trials adequately register their primary endpoints on the trial registry. So the current system is an important first step, but important improvements need to be made.
What's the reluctance for doing that, for doing the registration?
It's not entirely clear. I mean, the trial registry asks for very basic information. It may be that those who are actually entering this information are unaware of exactly what they should be entering, or it may be a reluctance to reveal what the study is about before the patients are actually recruited. There is sort of a culture of secrecy among researchers to kind of protect their ideas until they have to be revealed.
Well, you have been pushing for more transparency for a long time when it comes to disclosing the results of clinical trials, and medical journals are only one part of that. Ultimately, who is responsible for making that happen?
Well, I think we all have a responsibility. There are various key players, including ethics committees, funding agencies, regulators, researchers themselves, and journals. I think a key solution is to improve public access to all information about clinical trials. And this includes how the study was designed, what were its methods, what was planned, as well as the results. And currently, this information is largely unavailable. All we have is a short synopsis of the methods, in the journal article, for example, or in the study registry. And certainly, as we've seen with Dr. Tanak's study, not all of the results are available. I mean, it's shocking that half of clinical trials remain unpublished, and there's substantial evidence of this. And even when a clinical trial is published, only half of the results are actually reported in the journal article. And overwhelmingly, it's the positive results that tend to be that appear in the journal literature, while the negative results are suppressed. And this situation is unacceptable because clinicians or physicians such as myself rely on the journal literature to guide our treatment decisions. So if we only have access to less than half of the clinical trial results that exist, and what we do have access to tends to be more positive, then we are making treatment decisions based on very poor information.
So the results that never get published, you're saying that there are whole trials where they just go into into some invisible place?
They never see the light of day.
Why would that be? And what are your concerns about that?
Well, the reasons are complex. There have been surveys of researchers asking why their study was unpublished. And a common reason is that, you know, a lack of time to write it up. The results did not turn out to be very interesting. And as we know, it's human nature to be more interested in reporting very exciting positive findings. So if you find that yours perhaps did not show that the new drug was beneficial or it was toxic, then it may not be as interesting. You may not prioritize it if you have other studies that are waiting to be written up. There is also some responsibility on the part of journals in that, you know, of course, as a publisher, they are more interested also in reporting and publishing positive studies.
But you're making the point that as someone who's making treatment decisions, you need the overview in order to know where to go.
Exactly. We need to have access to all existing information on a particular treatment so that we can decide whether it is beneficial for the patient and what risks there are. As in any medical decision, it's important to balance the benefits and the risks, and it's not kind of a black and white decision. And only with a full understanding of the benefits and risks can we truly provide the optimal treatment to patients.
So you and your colleagues have a checklist that you've created, and I know there are 33 points. We can't get them to them all, but what are you looking at?
Well, we feel strongly that it is critical to have full information on how the study was designed and what was planned. And so our checklist, based on evidence-based guidance, or provides evidence-based guidance on what information should be detailed in a methods document, otherwise known as a study protocol. And we call for this information to be made publicly available, for example, alongside a journal article, so that readers and doctors can judge for themselves whether the results of a published study can be trusted.
So there isn't a website, there's nothing else you can go to where you can search for results of a trial. If it's not published in a medical journal, you can't get your hands on it?
Well, right now, there is legislation, for example, in the United States that requires by law that all results for clinical trials of drugs or devices be registered on a trial registry within a year of completion. However, that only encompasses regulated drugs and devices. So, for example, for breast cancer surgery or other non-drug, non-device treatments, they would not be captured by this legislation.
And you're telling me that's what's going on in the States. What about Canada? What does Health Canada say about all of this?
Well, currently Health Canada does not even require that trials be registered to begin with. They encourage it, but there is no binding legislation requiring the registration of trials. So we're sort of lagging behind in terms of not only trial registration, but also the reporting of results on trial registries.
So how much does this hinder what your work is with when you're actually trying to treat a patient?
Well, as physicians, we currently have access to a minority of evidence and existing information. We know that only half of trials are currently published. And among published trials, only some of the results are reported. So we are clearly relying on a very biased subset of existing information. And the ultimate impact is that billions of dollars are wasted and hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost over the past two decades. And there's compelling examples, and some of which you have mentioned.
You know, if I was getting any kind of treatment for breast cancer, I'd be really worried listening to you right now.
Well, I would be cautious with relying on the medical literature. I mean, I don't think it's a black and white issue where, you know, all of our decisions are completely unreliable at present. And it does vary by medical disease, by medical intervention. So I wouldn't say that, you know, medicine is entirely broken, but we could certainly do much better to ensure that we're weighing the risks and the benefits of our treatments in an optimal way.
And I guess if you want to do better as a doctor, you have to spend a lot more time going through the paperwork then for your patients.
Yes, and rely on other independent sources to synthesize the information.
Anwen Chan, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Anwen Chan is a scientist at Women's College Hospital and Research Center in Toronto and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. John Fletcher is still listening to us. He's the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Dr. Fletcher, what do you think? How do we? Who has the responsibility to make this work better then?
Well, I referred earlier on to the incentives built in the publishing world for journals to publish research that's going to be well read. There's a new movement in medical journals called the open access movement, where it's not the readers who pay for research, but it's the funders of research who pay for research. So that there's much more prospect now for all medical research that is conducted to be published in an open access journal if it can't get into one of the top line journals. And there's been an explosion of publication of that research that previously was not reaching the light of day. And I think my second point about for people who want to find out what works would be, again, to emphasize, read reviews. Don't read the latest research. Read the summaries of research that you'll find in reviews.
Okay, Dr. John Fletcher, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
That is Dr. John Fletcher, editor-in-chief of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. He was in our Ottawa studio. And if you want to weigh in on this story, go to the website, cbc.ca/thecurrent. Click on the on Contact Us. And you can also find us on Twitter. We're at TheCurrentCBC. Facebook.com/CBCTheCurrent. Or call us at 1-877-287-7366. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening to The Current.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.